We have a full agenda today. Councillor Sam Chase and Bob Stacey are excused. So we will start, and I'm going to do a safety briefing. It is my turn, evidently. Everybody must have pointed fingers at me. The safety briefing is that we are on the third floor of this building. In the event of a fire or fire alarm, please exit out through the door in the northeast corner of this room. Go down the steps to the second floor and exit through the main entrance by the reception desk. We will meet in the courtyard outside at that entrance. In the event of a medical or fire emergency, please call 911 and notify the security agent at the front desk. The nearest defibrillator is mounted on the steps leading from the reception down to Grand Avenue, and there is a fire extinguisher located to the quarter to the right of the dais as you leave the chamber. So with that, we should all feel safer. There will be a test. work session, let's move on to our first work session topic, and that is jurisdictional transfer assessment. And Margie Bradway from Metro Planning and John Merman are here for a presentation. Thank you.
I'm going to grab my...
Hi, thanks for having us. My name is Margie Bradley, I'm Deputy Director of the Planning and Development Department. And with me today is John Merman, who is a senior planner, and he's also acting as the project manager for this effort. I want to give a background on the issue and just an overview of where we're headed, and then John's going to dive into next steps. So the jurisdictional transfer assessment process came out of the 2018 RTP discussion, and as the JPAC councillors know well, one of the reasons it really became a topic of discussion was through the project identification process. So just as a reminder, we have a big project list in the RTP. That is a big gathering of projects from TSPs and other plans. That includes ODOT and TriMet. So when we gathered all the projects together, we really highlighted what was there and what was missing. And what was missing from the state list was these candidates for jurisdictional transfer, often called orphan highways. And what we saw is that local jurisdictions were particularly willing to put their constrained fund against them. In fact, we totaled it, and it was just over $800 million of local funds on these roadways. And you may remember Alyssa Kenegayo came and presented at JPACT on this issue. And said, how are we going to move this orphan highway issue forward? So we really started to come tear it apart and say, what are the issues that we need to work on? What would we do if we did an assessment? And one of the things that we found was, first, we needed a way of understanding what is our regional priorities, because we have a lot of roadways like this. So we came up with factors. I'm not going to give John's presentation away. He'll go through that. But we also said, you know, really, a lot of times when the two parties, ODOT and Office of Jurisdiction, come together, they're wrestling with cost estimates and values, so how do we create kind of a cost estimate methodology around this? And to understand cost, I'm going to talk a little bit about the background and the history of disinvestment. Really, to understand why we have these arterials, you have to understand how highways were built in the Portland region, back to President Eisenhower. I'm not going to have a history lesson, but really that's when the highway system was built. I-84 was the, back then, Banfield was the first one built after the, using shorthand, but the National Highway Act. It was actually called the National Highway and Defense Act. And if I'm going to jump to a map, this is an ODOT map, you can zoom in. This is their current pavement rating map for the Portland region. But what you can see is you can see that it was very intentional at that time to build the interstates parallel to the existing roadways. So, for example, Barber was acting prior to World War II, was the way south in Oregon. It was the only way south that was a major roadway. It was very intentional to I-5 to be built parallel to that. Again, you take I-84 and 30, you can start to see it. Highway 26 was built as an alternative to TV Highway. And all of these were built between the 1960s and the 1980s. The last to be built was 205 and 1983. And starting really in 1983, you started to see the intentional decision-making around de-investing in those old farm-to-market roadways, what a lot of people call orphan highways. When I talk about disinvestment, I'm talking about lack of investment, just to be clear. And there's two ways how I think of it. There's two ways to think about investing in infrastructure. You invest in the maintenance, what assets you have there, which this list is reflective of, and you also invest in the capital. For the maintenance, it's kind of keep what you've got and keep it in good condition. For the capital investments, which are reflected in the RTP list, and maintenance is not, you're really talking about what do we need to invest in this roadway to reflect the current land uses and the current user travel behaviors on this roadway. For these now arterials, just de-invested arterials, neither was invested. So it was kind of a two-part problem. And I know this map is hard to see, so I'm going to have a few more slides to zoom in and really hit home on this point. Now, I think everybody's familiar with 82nd Avenue. What you may not know is it carries the most transit riders in the entire region. It also has one of the highest crash rates, or the highest crash rate, I believe, in the entire region. And 82nd was the way to the airport. It was the only way to the airport until 1982 when I-205 was built. And it looks very different. And for all those roadways since 1982, fast forward to today, land use has changed. It's no longer a market-to-farm road, but the roadway really hasn't changed. And you can see that I tried to zoom in on that map. Green in ODOT's ranking means good pavement condition, and red means bad, and purple means pretty bad. So look at I-84 and look at 82nd. It doesn't get any clearer than that. You can actually start to see Columbia and I-84 if you prepare look at that. Again, I'll go back to Barber. This was Barber Boulevard. That picture was taken in 1948, again, before World War II, before the Eisenhower era. After World War II. I'm sorry. Thank you. After. But before the big investment began in the 60s. Thank you. And here it is today. A very different roadway, very different land uses, and obviously a key corridor for us. I don't have to talk about why this roadway is so important to Metro. If you kind of zoom in, this is a little harder to see, but you'll see the red. You see green, kind of left over, is that squiggle that goes down. You see I-5 right next to it, green, kind of yellow, and then becomes very red as it goes into Tigard. That other red line is Hall Boulevard, which is also commonly referred to as a candidate for jurisdictional transfer.
Which is actually State Highway 141, as it indicates on here.
Right, exactly. These are all state, technically all state highways.
Is Hall Boulevard the... 141.
Yeah, that red one right there.
It's Hall Boulevard.
So, one of my colleagues said, and I just because I want to set the stage before we talk about problem solving, that we really shouldn't be calling these orphan highways. We should be calling these foster children because we know who the parent is. and it's a little quip, but. Really, what we have on our hands is years and years of the state looking away, and now we are as a position as a regional government of working with locals to figure out how to problem solve. So we're going to put our best foot forward, and we're calling candidates for jurisdictional transfer to get away from the highway. I know I'm not going to use the foster children term anymore, but I think I made my point. We're going to find a way to get out of this rut, out of this disinvestment, and move forward. And so we've proposed a planning process to do that, and I'm going to let John walk you through that.
Thank you, Margie. Okay. See that?
Great. Oh, I didn't go into the Oregon Highway Plan policy, but you skipped to the... I think I made my point. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks very much. So the purpose of this jurisdictional transfer project is to identify these potential state-owned routes that could be good candidates for transfer, identify the gaps and deficiencies along them, which will help inform the cost estimates, which is a key aspect of making transfers happen and how much it would cost to do so, prioritize the routes in, throughout the region in terms of likelihood and importance and priority for transfer, and lastly, address some of the barriers and opportunities to transfer. So I'm going to walk through briefly the four steps we envision in this process. The first is to identify the roadways that might be candidates for transfer. And this map, which you have before you, is a map of the Oregon Highway Plan state highway classifications for all the state-owned roads in the region. It's important to note this map hasn't been updated since 1999, so it's not that up to date. As part of this process, we might recommend some updates to it, which we think would be pretty logical. Just to let you know what you're seeing here, the blue are the statewide functional routes. The orange are district and red are regional. We think that the regional and district are kind of no-brainer potential candidates for transfer, whereas the statewide ones would be more of a case-by-case analysis and decision to see whether they actually do still perform a statewide function, because some of them might not. It's also important to note that one of the steps involved with this part of the process is to identify segments of the roadway that could be jurisdictional, transferred jurisdictionally, because these roads go through multiple jurisdictions. They go through different cities. So where would be the beginning and end points for a potential segment to transfer? The next step, yep.
I think I follow you when you say that roadways that might be candidates for transfer, and then you have district, regional.
I understand state highways that would be transferred, but what are district and regional?
So where this is map highlights the disconnect between
the ODOT classifications, are they not?
Correct. The disconnect between the ODOT classifications and the Oregon Highway Plan. We have our own classifications in the RTP. These are hugely outdated. So what John is suggesting that as part of this process, we will be submitting a formal request to the OTC to update these classifications that no longer reflect the land uses in the region.
So it's like Craig said, those titles are given, that's an ODOT term.
These are all ODOT terms, yes. And we disagree with the current classification, and that, again, kind of leads into some of the issues, the classification, the urban design issues.
Thanks. I was just going to add, usually the disconnect between what the perspective that we have in the region, whether it's a city, a county, or us, is that we're looking at how we want the road to function, and ODOT usually looks at how people are using it, even if they're using it incorrectly and it's unsafe. So they design to accommodate a behavior that is unsafe. Whereas we would want to say, let's actually design it so it's self-enforcing for that speed limit in an urban area. They would say, well, the 85th percentile is driving at that, so we'll just sign it for that or better. So that's a lot of the disconnect. And is that a good perspective?
Correct. That's a great example, President Peterson. Say, for example, a local jurisdiction submits a request to reduce speed. They have to put on the form the ODOT classification. That form goes to an engineer that's sitting in the technical building in ODOT in Salem. They don't know that roadway. All they see at the top is that state classification, and they will potentially approve or deny it based on that classification. It becomes a problem.
Great, thank you. So in this step two, we'd have both a needs assessment and a prioritization of the corridors. So within the needs assessment, we'd be looking at what's the condition of the asset, what's the pavement condition. You saw the ODOT map recently with the red and green on it. Be looking at that in detailed form, looking at the condition of the completeness of the pedestrian network. Are there sidewalks missing? Are they too narrow? Where, you know, what is the situation for walking along these roads? Transit service, are they a road that has transit service currently or planned to have one? And then safety, what is the crash data telling us about the safety outcomes along these roads? In terms of ranking and tiering them, we'd be developing a methodology for doing that as part of this, and we would be making recommendations for the highest tier, middle tier, and lowest tier roadways. Step three is doing the cost methodology, really important step. So we'd be looking at the maintenance conditions, pedestrian network, transit network, and safety. What are the costs relating to each of those four factors that would be involved with handing over one of these facilities? The last step is a capability assessment, looking at the capacity and readiness of a city or county to take on ownership of one of these facilities, because it is a big deal, and assess the likelihood of investments in the near future as part of that. The final report that would come out of this project would include that regional prioritization that I've mentioned. It would establish an agreement on a regional approach going forward for how jurisdictional transfer happens in our region, and make a recommendation on funds to pursue for transfer. This report would be housed in the next RTP technical appendix, so 2023 RTP update. That's our next one upcoming, so we'd have a place for it to live and people able to access it easily. It's important to mention, before I get to next steps, what's not going to be in this final report. So this final report is not going to include any final cost estimates for any individual facility to transfer it. It's not going to force any commitments upon any jurisdiction. We're really sensitive to local jurisdictions' concerns about this, and we don't want this to be looked at something that's being done to them. This is being something that's done for them to make these easier to happen if they're something that both parties desire. Next steps in this process, I'll be briefing JPAC this Thursday. We have an RFP out on the street for a consultant to help us with this work. We'll be evaluating the proposals in the coming month, negotiating scope, schedule, and budget, briefing TPAC, and getting work underway by July. And I just wanted to end with the policy questions that we included in your work session worksheet and open the floor.
Questions?
I'll go first, and then I have some questions after that. From the presentation, just on the first question, equity, I didn't necessarily see an overlay on any of the corridors for what racial equity could look like in terms of primary indicators.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I brought this because I thought we were going to get a question, and I agree. I think we put in the write-up of the RTP, just so you know, that it's supposed to be an overlying lens on the whole tiering, but it wasn't best reflected in the PowerPoint. And I brought this up. It's very similar to the one up there. When you look at, in fact, if you go back to the ODOT mapper, you vision it in your head, you know, you can see there's a huge connection between these arterials, crashes, and equity. This is TV Highway, right? Here's Highway 26 that was built new. Very little crashes, very little communities of color. Look at TV Highway. You look at 82nd, same thing. You know, here it is. Communities of color, crashes, and then you look at I-84. Now I'm not facing this. But it's just kind of a mind-boggling overlap between high crash corridors, equity, and these candidates for jurisdictional transfer. And it all goes back to that, you know, changes in land use, changes in user, but also the de-investment and those corridors. So how we proposing, we really wrestled with how to take into account equity because it's not something that you can put in a number for the cost methodology. The cost methodology is very much an engineering, but we thought that the equity lens and the write-up right now, the proposal is to use that as a tiering for JPAC to say that that is either more of a priority or less of a priority based on that tiering. If that works for you, Councillor Gonzalez, and I'm happy to brainstorm with you on how best to bring equity in.
Yeah, I think some brainstorming would be good because, I mean, in terms of JPAC, and I haven't had the opportunity to work very closely with the members on JPAC, but I feel like it could be fairly subjective if we're going to tier based on that, or I guess I just need to see more method, what the methodology would be of the connection with the RTP map, right, and helping lead with those indicators.
Great. We can do that, and I'll get back to you on that.
Awesome. Councillor Lewis and then Councillor Craddock.
Sure.
For kind of two parts. One, just responding to the question you put in front of us, I do think safety, pedestrian, and transit networks, particularly with the equity overlay, like those are the right criteria. But when it comes to asset condition, are you thinking about just mapping asset as they currently stand, or is there any kind of change over time, both rate of deterioration, but also ease of getting back up to an operations and maintenance schedule that we can nod our heads and say, yes, that's reasonable?
This is a question, great question. Found it in my heart. It's the good, fair, bad system is the pavement rating that you saw is standard. It is standard across DOTs across the country. And so a lot of people will get really used to it. What it doesn't show, and I think this is part of your question, is when something gets bad, what does that mean? And it is a huge amount of difference, and President Pearson knows this, of doing a 2-inch overlay, a 3-inch overlay, then a grind and pave versus a rebuild. And 82nd is a rebuild, and it's gotten really bad, and some of those are a complete rebuild. And once you get, your deterioration gets so low, it gets extremely expensive. It's night and day between just like a 2 or 3-inch overlay. So, yes, it doesn't give you that sense of scale, and I think we need to capture that. Interesting part about the way ODOT has set up their Street Saver. So I know the ODOT Street Saver system and the PBOT Street Saver system, which is a common tool that they use to pop out how they should tell their crews how to pave. And in the ODOT Street Saver system, they put in the good, fair, bad rating, but then they shove their state classifications against that. So you'll never see really pure pavement standards, so the interstate automatically pops to the top. So however, those rank, that map you saw is never really brought to the crews. All they get is kind of, this is the worst interstate, this is the worst interstate, right? And so then the ones that have a lower classification automatically get deprioritized with the crews. Does that make sense? So I wanted to kind of bust through that and get what I call pure Street Saver data from DOT.
Councilor Craddock? Oh, wait, Councilor Lucia, two questions? I'm sorry.
Yeah, second question, kind of a similar concept of kind of grading on a curve in terms of the capacity assessment, looking at some of the arterials most in need. They go through multiple jurisdictions. Will there be some weighting towards opportunities for jurisdictions who are working together in multiples to do this work, or could a road rise because one jurisdiction is ready and hungry and the others along there are not?
Another good question. So we went back and forth on this issue with ODOT quite a bit. I think drafting the scope of work, Randy Putney and I went through 22 versions. We ended on the 22nd. Goodness. And one of the issues that ODOT was really pushing on the rewrites of the scope was to say, you know, we need to do this capability readiness assessment right out of the gate because we want to identify the right people who are ready to take them. And I push back on that, and one of the reasons they're not ready is because they don't trust that all the issues have been thoroughly thought out, and they don't trust the cost methodology. So there's this really healthy tension of, if this person's ready to go, and oftentimes this is like some of the easier transfers, like section of Paul Boulevard or sections of Farmington Road. It's like, why don't we just reorientate those processes for this? And it's like, well, then we'll never deal with the difficult, complicated ones. So it's important to me anyway that we do that readiness assessment at the very end where we've walked them through and they feel comfortable where we've landed. And then we can start talking about who would be the best party. And honestly, the counties in Washington County and Clackamas County are going to play a huge role. I think they know that. But I do want to just recognize Mayor Doyle, who's been fantastic on this issue as well from Beaverton, has been very outspoken for the need to get this assessment off the ground. So we do see the suburban parties asking for this as well.
Councilor Craddock.
I have two questions. I want to go back to the equity. I appreciate you bringing that up. It seemed like that's one of the four major criteria that we're using in moving forward with our transportation funding measure, and of course, I mean, it's in the RTP. So it seems like that should really rise up pretty dramatically in this. And like Councillor Gonzalez mentioned, there isn't really much here, or there's nothing here. So I'm not sure if I followed you. So I would think that should be a significant part of this, and it should be very upfront. So repeat what you just said.
I agree, and I think I hear both you and Councillor Gonzalez and Councillor Craddock. Thank you very much. I think we've got some work to do to flesh out exactly how that equity lens fits in this, and we'll get back to you both. But I think what I was trying to say is that the cost methodology and some of that street saver stuff I talked about is in principle an engineering exercise. It's a highly technical exercise. The planning and the climate lens and the RTP is a planning lens, and so we're trying to kind of bring them together. And so it's like you need to do some planning up front on the classifications. You need to bring your engineers in and your kind of infrastructure specialist to do the cost methodology. And then I think the planning needs to come back at the end in the tiering to talk about the equity lens again. So I don't know, President Peterson, if you have any ideas on how best to do that. I see you leaning into your mic.
Leaning in. it just appears to me that what we're trying to do is a larger risk management conversation.
Yes.
Within the region. And what ODOT views as a risk management set of questions is very narrow. And we see things much broader. And so I guess what I would say is we could turn this whole thing into basically a technical risk management, and a lot of the questions that we're asking form them in ways that are about risk. Because what's happening is that we have higher risk to certain populations that's not being accounted for, right? And that is a risk of how do we actually increase safety and accessibility and economic development for communities that need it. That is not currently part of a risk management discussion at ODOT. So what we're trying to do is incorporate, so I would encourage us to let's formulate the full list of risks and those that are not being, it's like a benefit cost analysis at a higher level, right? At a much higher level. And then on the asset manage or asset condition, we started this at Clackamas County with ODOT when I was there. There was a discussion, a really good discussion. It came down to the liability issue, and that's why I think it should be in a risk management type of conversation, because there were underground storage tanks and stormwater management issues, and they were too expensive for Clackamas County to take on, and there was no money from ODOT. So it just died. And that was from McLaughlin in 43. So it's not just a maintenance issue, right? It's the other risks that are associated with taking on that asset, and it's the unknowns and the knowns. Some of those underground storage tanks were known; others are not known. So I encourage us to fully flush out asset and what the liabilities are, so that the cities and counties understand that and know how much that's part of the cost methodology, but also that we actually assess, it's essentially a cost, right, to those other risks that we have been ignoring, that are societal risks and credibility risks. So
My first intuition would be that map you just showed us, I would think if you went through all this process to evaluate from the technical side, and then you use that map at the end and say, okay, where is this, what we've identified here, so how is it influenced by that map? And I would think that would be the way we would look at that, and anything in the that was an area, a geographic area of the region that is, have people of color, I think we would say, yes, this is where we should be focusing our first effort.
Yeah, and just full disclosure, our GIS support person, Matthew Hampton's out for like a month. so I was like, how can I take that ODOT map, because it was in PDF and overlay of the map, and I couldn't do it in time. But I think when he comes back, doing some more of those overlays so that we've got, he can kind of superimpose the ODOT map over this map to really tell the story.
Yeah, and I think you're on the right track. I think the technical analysis needs to be done with all of the data, right? And then how do you prioritize them is kind of the second step. So I think you've got time to get ready for that second step of basically prioritizing and come back with some of this methodology and get input. But the first part is just what's the conditions of the asset? Are these the criteria you want to use or the underlying variables we want to use for some of these other things and then come up with a methodology for ranking? But clearly, obviously, I'm seeing head nodding around the council that that's a top criteria. Okay.
Well, and I think it's an RATP.
Yeah, and I think that's great council direction. One of the reasons we wanted to come to you now is because we're in the process of fleshing out the final, you know, scope of work when we bring the consultant team on. So we've got your council direction. I hear equity very strongly. I hear risk, benefit, and cost, kind of knowns and unknowns. And certainly when we get the first deliverable from our consultant team and the first body of work, we'll be back with updates to get your input.
One more question. Did you have a question?
Have a question.
Okay.
A statement.
I can make several comments.
Okay. Well, if I could ask this question, then I'll give the floor to you, if that's okay. Regarding the funding, so my experience with the jurisdictional transfer is Powell Boulevard. And, you know, we're finally at a point, Powell Boulevard is being, the construction's underway, and at the end it will be given to the City of Portland. But nothing happened until the state legislature set those funds aside, and we set funds aside to help with some of this. So I guess when you say recommendation on funds to pursue, at what point will the transfer occur? Will it be occurring after the construction actually occurs? And then if so, whose design guidelines and standards are they using to build the road?
I'm going to answer this in the different order you asked those questions. The first part was, when does the transfer happen? In history, transfers have happened in all different ways, and one of the first consultant tasks is to identify best practices in the space based on other transfers that have happened in the Portland area and then some have happened in the Eugene area. That was particular to the Powell deal, and that deal was struck. I happened to be working for City of Portland, involved in that deal in a legislator's office down in Salem. You know, if I fund this, then this transfer will happen that way. That was not best practice. And what we're trying to do is kind of say what is best practice? How and when should these transfers happen? And what are some good examples? The second part is really, you know, that funding is by far the biggest barrier. But the feedback we got, and there is a bill, although I don't think it's going where, to be honest, that Alyssa Kindergartner introduced on jurisdictional transfer. The question we get most in Salem is, we can't give you funding for all of these corridors. It's too much. It's too many. So what are your top three? And what I'm hoping is, in terms of messaging to the legislature and the OTC, we have enough consensus that it's very similar to the highway conversation we had around Rose Corridor 217, I-205, where there was a lot of consensus in the region that these are the top priorities that we're all going to get money for, whether it was from the legislature or other sources, federal funding. I'm hoping to create that kind of energy around this. And we'll see how these dynamics play out as part of the T2020 measure. It's undoubtedly related.
Councilor Dirksen.
Well, addressing the policy questions, I think the challenge agreeing to the three that are mentioned there and then the asset condition as well is that they're really one and the same. When it comes to the issue of equity, safety, and multimodal mobility, it's based on how you or how different communities use the facilities. And that's really the challenge with the region trying to work with ODOT about that, because of their different perspective than we have on what those roads are even supposed to do. For ODOT, if it's a blue highway, if it's part of the state system, then the purpose of that highway is to move the most vehicles through that area as smoothly as possible. And how that facility functions in conjunction with the land uses adjacent to it and the other roadways that intersect with it are either secondary or completely immaterial. for the other roads that ODOT has identified as either regional or district highways, that means in their eyes they no longer function as part of the state system. So that means improving them, spending money on them, would not help them achieve their mandate, their goal of maintaining and improving the state system. So they automatically drop to a lower level of importance. So when we look at how those are used in the region by the people who live in the region and what those needs are, they're just at odds with ODOT. It's not that ODOT doesn't recognize that. It's just that because of their own needs, and they have limited funding just like everybody else, they need to put their money where it's going to meet their mandate to maintain the state system. That doesn't make it any better than any other outlook, because we still don't get what we need out of it. I say that those are one and the same is because if you're a person who's just using those secondary facilities twice a day to get to and from your job, they probably function okay, other than the fact that they may get congested, and B, there may be potholes that mess up the alignment on your car. But if those roadways actually go through your community where you live, you're not using them just twice a day traveling through. That's how you get around your neighborhood. It's how your kids get to school. It's how you go to the store. You're walking, biking. You're trying to get to transit. So that creates a completely different need that roadway needs to function as, rather than for a commuter or as a state highway just passing through. So when you talk about equity, it's how does it serve, how is it not serving that local community that lives right around it, when it now needs to do that, when the highway was built in the first place, and in the eyes of ODOT, because of what the way it thinks it needs to function, those two needs just don't match. And that matters whether you're talking about who lives there, or how safe it is for who, or how multimodal it is. I just driving your car is different than pushing your child in a carriage down a ditch or a shoulder, or do you get a sidewalk? Yeah.
I feel like we're all getting kind of worked up with you, Margie.
I have a question. In terms of, it might not be cost methodology, but assuming that the jurisdictional transfer is completed, what would hypothetically happen on the back end, considering, would there be an update to the funding model, so the 50-30-20, are there dollars tied on relative proportionally from the budget that would be reallocated to local jurisdictions? And if not, how do we anticipate our local jurisdictions' budgets being able to manage these new big, big corridors and facilities?
That may be something your generation will be able to achieve.
Great question. Well, I think that's part of the frustration with 50-30-20 is that it goes with no constraints. So that gas tax, 50% goes to ODOT. They put it through their step. OTC has a large amount of discretion to program that as they please. But the other essential question is what happens after transfer? How do these maintenance budgets go? And I think that is the hardest question for any jurisdiction. And I know from my experience working in the city of Portland, they were comparing the risks of the cost of death and fatalities to their constituents. They were taking the big picture versus the cost of maintaining those streets. So what does it cost to society to lose somebody's mother, father, kid? And that's how they were kind of penciling it. But they also have kind of a more flexible budget than some jurisdictions. I know for Clackamas County and just the initial conversations I've had with our staff, that is the issue for them, and they really want us to dive into this as part of this process of how would we maintain. And I think everybody here knows that they have Clackamas County in particular has less flexibility in their transportation budget than the other counties. So it's an unanswered. But I'm just wondering how City of Portland really wrestled with that and came. They kind of took this big picture view. They're transferring Powell. They've got an agreement to transfer Barber if Southwest Corridor gets funded, and they're starting to pretty seriously talk about 82nd now. But they've had to have some tough conversations at their city council over this.
When you say less flexibility, you basically just mean they have less to work with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have a funding mechanism dedicated unless you count the VRF, which is new right. And under threat.
Yeah. Great question.
Yeah. So is this the JT assessment, JT like Justin Timberlake?
Right.
is the assessment going to be a part of the transportation package next year? Are we anticipating baking it into what we tell the voters, and this is the methodology we're going to use to do these interjurisdictional transfers and things like that?
Well, what is the short answer? The short answer is this is a planning effort. This is going to inform all sorts of conversations. It's going to provide a basis for best practices and cost methodology. That said, if the T20 committee and this council decides that there's a potential for transfers on the table, then I think whatever lessons we learn or whatever consultant work is done as part of this process that would help inform this process over here could be picked up and used. But I don't want to tie them together. Is it helpful that they're happening at the same time? Probably.
I have another question if I can. So can you walk me through a scenario? I don't know why when I said that I felt like this is a congressional hearing. Can you walk me through? can you walk me through a scenario? Let's say there's a hypothetical road in Washington County that goes from Beaverton to Forest Grove. That's a state highway, hypothetically. And let's assume that next year the region, the constituents adopt a measure that allocates a multiple number of Bs of dollars to fund transportation projects. How long would it take for said hypothetical highway in Washington County from Beaverton to Forest Grove to be transferred, to be rebuilt to the new to new guideline standards and in operation?
Those are two different questions, I think. Yes. And they need to be broke down, because one is what outcomes are we actually buying with the measure? And when does the jurisdictional transfer take place? And then what's left over that we couldn't do because the jurisdictional transfer had not taken place?
Right. And that's not, I'm not going to try to forecast any political things that are thrown away on a daily basis. But again, you're asking, how would this happen? And I think I would rather use 82nd as an example, because it's a very real example. But it's a very 82nd's issues are just remarkably similar to TV Highway. They're similar size, they're similar ridership, they're similar demographic breakdown. So 82nd I can talk about because that's happening right now. And so what's happening is the City of Portland says, okay, we think we want to transfer, but we don't want to transfer. We want to sign an MOU for you, ODOT, to pay for the assets. Because we don't believe, that's what the current position is, because we don't believe that we should have to, or Metro should have to, as part of the measure, so this is the stance they've taken as of last week, to pay for the assets, we'd like you to go find $250 million.
When you say assets, do you mean
maintenance?
So we maintain, but yes. So if that money is spent on bringing it back to par of a state highway system versus a different community system?
Well, the simplest way to say it is bringing it right away, that bad condition, to green.
Okay.
To good. That's what they want. They want the potholes and the rebuild of the roadway to be brought up. And they said, in other words, we will take care of either the funding or the funding strategy to make the capital improvements, sidewalks, crosswalks, lighting, that's needed for 82nd. Every conversation is different. And so I don't know what T20 TV highway is going to be like, and I think it's very likely that Washington County is the lead negotiator. I think there's conversations. It's not, there's an executive committee in the TV highway corridor plan right now, which we paid for. We gave $500,000 to Washington County to pull this together, to have some tough conversations about the future of that corridor. And jurisdictional transfer is being openly discussed, but I don't know where those electeds are and what kind of conversations they're having, either amongst themselves or with ODOT. But if it ends up being a measure, well, that's going to have to be sorted out.
Thank you.
Are we good? Okay, one last question. And then we really do need to go to budget.
All these certified smart people are in the back meeting.
Hopefully it's quick. President Peterson mentioned the utilities that were underneath 99E and 43 are utility evaluations part of readiness assessment.
We are not going that far, but I get the council direction and we will make it so.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yes.
You're going to find those issues throughout the region, so it's something we need to account for.
I'm hoping the risk assessment process that Kittleson does for us as part of the measure can also inform this a little bit. So, you know, we've got two related processes going on.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Good work. Looking forward to next steps. Thanks for checking in. And we'll move on to the budget work session. We've got Tim Collier, our Metro Finance and Regulatory Services Director, here for an update. And I guess the way the timeline will work, and Tim, you can kind of go through this, but we have the opportunity to kind of flesh out just kind of some of the things that the counselors might be thinking of that were not included in the budget. And then and you can go over this, but I just want to lay this out. In the next few weeks, we will actually be looking at counselor-provided forms for proposals.
Correct.
I just wanted to make it clear of when we're going to be talking about things.
Counselor, first, I'm Tim Collier, Director of Finance, and with me is Lisa Houghton, our Finance Manager. So, our Financial Planning Manager, sorry.
That one is.
Oh, yeah.
It is. So today what we're going over, again, we proposed the budget on last Thursday, and so today really is an opportunity for us to review the timelines with you, talk about some potential amendments and what that process looks like, and then really this gives you an opportunity, as Council President Peterson discussed, to kind of talk about any additional ideas that you may have that we can amend the budget with in the near future. So, and of course, answer any questions that you have. We have all of the finance managers here ready for you if you have anything specific you would like to ask. So, with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa and we'll go from there.
Good afternoon, Council President and Councilors. I am Lisa Houghton, Financial Planning Manager. So, there are some documents in front of you, and I'll briefly review them. They were provided to you via email and today. I'm going to highlight some of the upcoming dates in the budget process, and we will take any questions that you may have. There are five documents in the package that was distributed today, and I'll begin with the first two. The first is a copy of the budget timeline presented to you in the proposed budget presentation last Thursday, and it basically provides like a 30,000-foot view. The second is a more detailed calendar outlining key dates for the council in the upcoming months. The calendar has been revised since it was last emailed to you to reflect an additional council work session on June 4th. The June 4th work session will provide opportunities for council discussion of the fiscal year 19-20 budget amendments brought forward for your consideration. You're scheduled currently to approve the budget for transmittal to the TSCC at the May 2nd council meeting, and there will be an opportunity for public comment on the budget at that time. The TSCC public hearing is scheduled for Thursday, June 6th at 12:30. The TSCC will provide us a list of their questions for discussion at the hearing, and you will be provided copies of those questions and management responses prior to the hearing. Final adoption is scheduled for June 20th. There will be additional opportunities for public comment at both of the council meetings in June, and that ends basically the discussion of the two calendars for now. The next two documents relate to several of the opportunities Council has to approve amendments to the fiscal year 19-20 budget. The first is a memo outlining the process and timeline council has historically chosen to use in proposing council amendments and considering and voting on both councilor and department amendments. The second is the form that we request council and their policy advisors use to send our amendments to financial planning. There were no substantive changes in this form from the prior years, although I tried to clarify some of the instructional text that is outlined in blue font. As in the past, councilors are asked to provide a suggestion for an option for balancing the budget should be approved, but it is not required. If council continues to propose and consider their amendments between the approved and adopted stages, then council amendments would be due to financial planning by Tuesday, May 21st, and the council will consider and vote on both councilor and department amendments at the June 13th meeting. Please note that in addition to this opportunity to amend the fiscal year 19-20 budget, there are several additional opportunities for you to amend the budget. Tim will discuss these opportunities in more detail. There's one additional budget-related item provided to you today, and it's a two-year history of special appropriations, including community partnerships and the regional investment strategy. And with that, are there any questions that you would like to ask?
Anybody have any follow-up questions from last week?
Documents are in our packet.
They are not in your packet.
Okay.
Which documents?
Your paper.
In front of you.
Okay. Consistent with prior years, because we're adjusting this as we go, I believe the calendar, the budget amendment, and the calendar were presented to you early.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Councilor.
I do have one very minor question. It has it's on the two-year comparison.
Certainly.
And it has to do with the TriMet Transit Pass. And my question is there are, even in the council office, there are several of us who qualify for honored citizen reduced cost.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if that when the annual passes are distributed to us, is that taken into consideration?
No, there's actually a really complex methodology that TriMet sets out, and actually when you take, sometime in the month of June, you will take a survey, or sometimes it's as late as July, what TriMet sends to us, and it asks you essentially how you got to work. And the price we pay is based on the share of employees who use transit primarily to commute and the number of trips they take every month. So it's actually substantially lower, although a lot of people use transit here at MRC, so we pay quite a lot, but then we would have paid even with your honored citizen discount for the sticker.
So I wasn't here last time, so I just wanted to talk about the items that I'll be bringing up when we come to that point. One of them has already been included in the sheet that has the special appropriations.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You graciously added, and we should discuss, membership to ITS America. So Intelligent Transportation Systems America has added a new program. Normally I wouldn't be asking for membership into them, but they have added a new program that I think we should be part of, which is Mobility on Demand and the policies at the federal level around that, which we are certainly working on here at Metro. So I want to make sure that we're part of that federal discussion around policy development around autonomous vehicles and shared vehicles, TNCs.
It's just in there.
Yeah. And data management, that sort of thing. So that's one thing. The special appropriations.
It's only membership and professional dues.
$10,000.
Yeah. It's on this one, yeah.
That was the first. And then the second, which will be coming to you, is a proposal for a very low-cost way to start out the Metro Conservation Corps and then grow it over time. So that'll be coming next.
I have a question under contracted professional services, community partnerships. Is that ending? Can you explain a little more what that is?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear which one.
Oh, under it's on the special appropriations page, mm-hmm. under contracted professional services. Oh. The first item has $317,000, and then the proposed for next fiscal year.
Yes. So in prior years, we had the community partnerships. The budget resided in the non-departmental part of the general fund. For this year, $150,000 is budgeted in the property and environmental services budget, and the other $150,000 is now budgeted in communications.
Oh, okay.
So the process and the projects are still funded. We've just moved the funding back to the departments.
Thank you.
Of course.
Yeah, Councilor Craddock.
Regarding the sponsorship expenditures, I'm curious about First Stop Portland. I know we've been a partner in that for many years, and Nancy Hales, I know when she was responsible, mm-hmm. she was very engaged in it, but I honestly haven't heard much about what that organization's doing. I know we don't get information, at least I don't. So are we is that an active organization?
Martha, do you want to answer?
Yeah, so we are still active at this point. They did just recently lose Sarah Iannarone. And we don't pay this amount until January of each calendar year. And so I have asked the Center for Public Service to give us a report prior to when the dues would be due in January of 2020, so we can continue, we can make a decision at that point. I will say we still do use them whenever we are requested to host a foreign delegation or a delegation from some other part of the country. Instead of doing that with Metro staff time, we send them to First Stop, who organizes the visit. And so it is a substantial savings to Metro. We don't have nearly the same level of activity we had, say, 10 years ago, but we still have somewhere between 6 and 10 delegations a year mm-hmm. that we send through First Stop as opposed to having to organize tours using Metro staff. But I do think that you deserve an update on where that program is headed now that they've had a second change in directors, and so we'll get that to you before we pay the dues. At the same time, I would recommend that you budget for it.
Yeah, no, I'm not opposed to it. I just hasn't been visible.
I was going back into the memory banks, and when I was at 1,000 Friends and at TriMet, I was doing about 10 to 12 tours a year. So I'm really happy that there's a First Stop Portland, but they have to be up and ready and willing to actually do this, and there's a question.
I don't want to add more work to the finance team, but in terms of... Not membership professional dues so much, those are self-explanatory in some ways, but under sponsorship expenditures, I guess getting, like Martha mentioned, for First Stop, a type of value report or just kind of what we get for the sponsorship, if to say it plainly, I guess I would like to see for example, Metro Export Initiative, I don't know what that is or why we're involved in that. I'm sure it's important, but I would like to learn about it.
Councilor Gonzalez, this is one that I would actually love to take on, but it's probably more geared to the council office.
Okay.
They would have to give you those details on this, so I'd be happy to express that to Ms. Zucker.
Thank you. And elections expenses, is that the cost of referring things to...
Correct. Or in some years, for example, when the councilors run, then we pay to the county, the county elections office for those elections.
I didn't know it cost money to put stuff on the ballot.
Just to confirm, so the government assessments levy contributions, this is what is expected of us in our contribution to the Levy Ready Columbia process. Is that right?
Or debt payment.
Yeah, correct. These are debt payments from the original assessment, which were a series of two loans that were taken out by the City of Portland, and we're repaying those.
Our share.
Yeah, our share.
Yes.
That's our share.
Right. And, of course, obviously, this is just this one year. Okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you. Anything else? Well, I'm sure you're available. Oh, I'm sorry, Councilor Lewis.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't publicly thank the team in particular for the work in response to my question. asked before the unveiling of the budget, but to prepare the data around vacancies. And I guess just to, one, thank you for that information, but two, to let my fellow councilors know that one of the things that I'm looking at is the ongoing and long-term vacancies, but more in the lens that when we are looking at this budget, it's putting a value on people, both those that we employ and those that we serve. And in some places, it's going to be in looking at the model that we're using to become an employer of choice. And in other areas, it's going to be really closely examining what we do around contracting out services. And there is definitely a place and time for contracting out, and there is definitely a place and time for developing that expertise internally. And just want to just let folks know that that's a line of thinking that I have when I look at this budget. And in particular, we'll likely be developing a proposal to bring to my fellow councilors around the HR budget to make sure that our new HR director has a full toolbox to work with, particularly for training of employees, but also to make sure that we are funding external evaluations when we hear reports of harassment and other sorts of disturbing behavior on the job. I want to be ready so that, one, from the risk perspective, but two, from a good employment perspective, that's something that we are addressing seriously as an agency.
Good.
Just one last thing, as Lisa mentioned, with regards to the budget amendment, so in this one here, to amend the 19-20 budget in this process, we're looking for the forms back from you on May 21st. But remember, we currently, or we normally have three budget time periods that we amend the budget. So once in November, March, and then May. And then again, as council, you can amend the budget at any time after July 1, 19. So there are plenty of opportunities for you to be able to amend the budget as you go forward into that year. So I just wanted to remind everybody of that.
Tim, or Lisa, do you want to also go over that there will be technical and substantive amendments that are advanced by the departments in June, so the council or budget amendments won't be the only ones they see? Do you want to just a very light touch on that?
Certainly. So each year the departments will look at projects that have been funded in the current year 18-19 that haven't gone as far along as anticipated, and they will submit a technical amendment saying we budgeted $300,000, we've only spent $150,000, so we'd like to carry $150,000 forward into the 19-20 budget, and that is considered a technical budget amendment, and all of the departments do that. I'll be pulling all those different amendments together. They very often range in the numbers of maybe even 30 amendments, and those will also be presented for you for your review and consideration. We ask that departments limit their substantive amendments at this time, where they want to ask for additional FTE or an additional program, but again, there is review of that by Martha and, well, not Tim this year, but Martha, and then, of course, you, where you evaluate whether or not, you know, those substantive amendments are something that you move forward. And then when we get to the point where we have another work session and we're looking at those amendments, something for you to consider is that we always ask the council if they want to vote for them as a block. I believe there's an actual technical term in block, or if you want to look at them individually by item. Usually because of the number of amendments, the council elects to vote on them in block. But again, that's for your consideration and determination.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right.
Thank you.
No, thank you. And Tim, since I wasn't here when you made your announcement, and I'm sure you all talked about it last time, but congratulations, and we're going to miss you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yes, amazing amount of good work that you've done at this agency, so thank you.
Thank you.
And your team.
I've got a great team. I do have a wonderful team.
I had one more question. I don't know if you're going to wrap up, or are you going
to
wrap up?
You're really trying to wrap up.
Okay, great. Right. So, I mean, since everyone's put so much work into the budget, I mean, I might as well, you know, honor that work. So, policy questions under the second bullet point, like Councilor Lewis and President Peterson mentioned earlier, anticipated amendments just to communicate with my colleagues in general. I had a good meeting with Sasha and her work with climate resilience, and I think that's wonderful. I'm going to try and work through something that could could help us also increase our activity in climate action mitigation, so in terms of coordinating our regional jurisdictions on that. So I'll work through something. There was also one other thing that I wanted to bring up around really increasing our presence in the region around culturally specific linguistic or language specific recycling campaigns for single family, multifamily units, really helping people feel really comfortable with recycling. And I think that actually works really well with Council President's Conservation Corps. I think those things could work together. But those are things that I had on my plate, and I'll be coming and asking you for more things. If you're already going to work on any of those issues, please bounce ideas with me. I would love to work with you.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we've got under our last item, legislative update. We've got Andy Shaw up for our legislative recap, blow by blow.
I don't actually have a lot for you today. We reported in last time on some updates, and we've passed now the deadline for bills to get out of their first policy committee. Most of the bills that we've been tracking have indeed moved on to either Ways and Means or the Rules Committee. A quick note, I shared with you, we had gotten a bill introduced to address the vending issue around the Commission for the Blind. That bill apparently got referred to the wrong committee. And so a new bill is being introduced, which will be a Rules Committee bill as opposed to introduced by an individual member. So we'll get you the update on that bill number, but all should be well still. Same language, just a new number. The only other thing, Randy Tucker testified last week against a bill. I think we might have informed you about he was going to last week. This is a bill that has been proposed before. It would allow essentially a large freeway on the west side of the region overseen by a new district that would be free from many of the rules that our region and cities and counties are required to follow, land use, transportation, other various rules. So a bill reintroduced on behalf of a legislator who is no longer in the legislature. He did show up to testify for the bill, and Randy signed up to testify against it. Only one other person signed up to testify at all, and there were no questions asked. So just to give a sense of how the committee, it was what we call a courtesy hearing, but we did put ourselves on the record. And Randy also organized a letter from many of the counties, cities, and other partners just expressing this is outside the process of collaboration that we all use to advance transportation proposals. The concept has been floated around for many years, but has not elevated itself up through the local process into our region's transportation plan. So just want to make sure you knew we were down there doing that. The other big thing that's going on right now in the legislature is the introduction of legislation around funding for schools and the reforming PERS as a combination deal. The Committee on Student Success, I think it's called, is going to be reviewing a bill on increasing the corporate tax and in a combination of gross receipts and corporate activity tax. In addition to that, they're looking at reducing the income tax in the state. So there, you can see sort of the grand bargainish concept there, connecting that then to proposals for reducing costs of PERS and identifying resources to addressing the existing liability in PERS. What I'll flag for you is we've identified in language that's not yet been put into a bill that would preempt local governments around the gross receipts tax. So we're trying to really understand the full implication of that language before diving in, but I suspect we and other local governments will be quite concerned about that being part of the package to fund schools, not to have any implication around the importance of funding schools, but to ensure that there's room for local jurisdictions to figure out how to make all the other kinds of investments that we all know are required in our transportation system and affordable housing and homelessness and other issues like that. So we're investigating, trying to understand, see where that came from, understand what the language actually means, what it would prohibit, what it wouldn't prohibit, before we dive in an advocacy mode. I think that's all I really have. Most of the bills, we're still working on language with the Speaker's office on House Bill 2001, which is legislation around allowing middle housing, but also has some language being considered around our UGB process and how we forecast or whether we forecast using all the data at our disposal or not. The plastic bag ban legislation has moved forward. The carbon bill language, we've got new language out. I think I reported last time. It's decent language. It's not everything we wanted. It's not everything anybody wanted. But we're moving in the right direction and think it sets the stage well for further discussions later in the legislative session. Any questions you have about?
Yes, I have a question on what you could call it the missing middle bill. And I don't know if you've seen a couple of emails that we've received from Mayor Jerry Sciarrato from Durham. And he had expressed some concerns of some language that he saw in the bill. The bill as a whole addresses the issues around allowing multifamily in single family zoning in cities over 10,000. But then he expressed concern that he had seen language that there were certain communities within a larger area that are under 10,000 that it would apply to as well. And I actually went back and I looked at the amended bill, and I wasn't able to find that language. Is it actually there, or is that an issue that is of concern to very small jurisdictions within the Portland metro area?
I'll have to go back and review it more carefully myself now that you have looked at the amendments that have been proposed. My understanding is it treats the metro area differently than the rest of the state. And this is language that essentially redefines what single-family zoning is and makes it clear that duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes would be, and townhomes and cottage clusters, I think, are in there as well, would be allowed in zone on properties that are zoned as single-family. It does exempt some smaller jurisdictions around the state. My recollection last we looked at it was that it treated all the cities, I think it's above 1,000 population in the metro area, the same. And we also suggested them, they include the unincorporated areas within the metro area that are within counties, which they did in the last version of the bill. But I can check that just to make sure.
So we're coordinating a response to the mayor through me, and you can all see that, but I also expect to talk to him before I send that letter. Because we've been very supportive of a fairness issue region-wide, right, that everybody takes up their fair share.
I think his concern is less around the impact that it would have on zoning in his community, more the impacts on the burden of administration of making those changes for very small jurisdictions with tiny administrative budgets.
Right, and I'm sure if they wanted to apply for a Metro 2040 grant,
yeah,
that we can make that clear.
Yeah. That may actually address a lot of his concerns.
Okay, yeah. Good. Good to know.
Any other questions or other issues like updates on? Great.
Good. Thank you.
Welcome.
Martha, any updates?
Yeah, there's two things I wanted to update you on. Actually, the second thing is a guest appearance by my solid waste friends, and so I'll invite them up. But the first thing I wanted you to know is that the Portland Business Journal announced the 40 Under 40 today, and our own John Brasher is one of the folks that they're recognizing. Woo! So they'll be, it's really awesome. There'll be a lunch in mid-June, and I'll get you the dates as soon as they come out. But if you want to see a picture of 40 amazing young leaders in the region, go look at that article, but also stop for an extra second and admire John Blasher's picture. With that, in celebration of Earth Day, Roy and Tom have some news to share with all of you.
Do we have slides queued up?
Good afternoon. Roy Brow, your interim Property and Environmental Services Director, and with me today is Tom Chainoff, Solid Waste Operations Director. And we had a couple of sort of good news events that have happened recently with Metro Paint. And the first is, hopefully it's the first picture.
Next.
There we go. We just recently completed the process. We've used temps for years out of St. Vincent de Paul, and we just completed a process of hiring 7 brand new Metro employees, and they're pictured here. They started just a month or so ago, and so they're on board producing recycled paint.
You recognize at least one right there in the middle, Mike Felice, who's been also serving a little tenure on the DEI team.
And the second piece of good news is, and I can pass this around, I guess we have pictures too. This is, we've had, I won't go into too much detail, but we've had some issues with declining paint sales over the years, partly in partnership with Miller Paint. They haven't been pushing our product. Thanks to the staff, Tom and Andrew Staub and Dan Blue, they invited the sales people in to the paint facility, showed them how the paint was made, ran through the process, asked for their ideas, and one of the things they came back with was this renewal paint with a promise that's being introduced on Earth Day, and this is a Miller-labeled new paint that's being produced by Metro, and I'll pass this around if you want to see it.
So essentially their staff weren't pushing the paint because they didn't know if it had a seal of approval or it didn't look like Miller paint?
It was not perceived as high a quality as it is.
As it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little easier to sell your own brand than somebody else's brand when it's in your store.
Right.
So, yeah, it just wasn't quite getting the attention that it deserved. So here we actually are selling Miller bulk paint in custom colors, custom sheen, made just for them, for that product line.
Wow.
And the hues that you'll be able to buy in that can are these lovely ones here on the screen. Those are indeed the names of the colors. And all the marketing was done by Miller in the course of about 2 months.
Wow.
Since this idea germinated, a couple of months ago. So they've done it all.
So they've kind of taken it as their product.
Yep, exactly.
That was a question I was going to ask. Is there do we have any opportunity that we could develop a similar partnership with other paint suppliers, other brands, Sherwin-Williams, Benjamin Moore, whoever?
Currently, Miller is our exclusive vendor of Metro Paint. That isn't to say we couldn't, but to date, they've been our sole vendor.
And as I understand how painters get their supply of paint is, you can give them a sample that you've got purchased from, or not purchased, but from someone paint store, say Benjamin Moore, and you give them that paint sample, and they go to their supplier who then mixes it. And so it's, even though it's a Benjamin Moore color, that doesn't mean it's Benjamin Moore paint. So have there ever been discussions about introducing Metro Paint into whatever that organization or company is that the professional painters use?
I don't know that there has. We would certainly welcome any professional painters to use this paint. For example, as you know, Metro South was recently painted with Metro Paint by a professional commercial painter who frankly raved about the quality and how it coats a building. So, there's opportunity there for sure.
Well, I just, even though, let's say, as a resident, I can go to Miller Paint and find my sample, but that doesn't mean that's what's going to go on my walls
right.
When the painter decides to paint.
Right. We're getting better about mixing and matching colors. It used to be that we had, a couple of colors, and now I think we've got a 100 or so that we can mix up, and I think we can color match.
Well, I didn't just say that we want to get into that supply line, have it be one of those products that they might choose. So, anyway.
Right. Is it too late to say every Metro Housing Bond project must be painted with Metro Paint? No.
That could be challenging.
We can suggest.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah,
that's
congratulations.
Really creative. Yeah.
Thank you. We just thought we would share that with you. We don't normally do this, but we thought this was a good news story.
Cool.
Just in time for Earth Day.
And it'll be on.
They're going to announce it on Earth Day, correct?
Yeah, it'll be on shelves by Earth Day. Yep.
I feel good. Thank you.
So you're embargoed until then, everybody. No painting. All right, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Good job. Anything else? Okay. Councilor Communication.
Couple things.
Okay.
As sort of a follow-up to legislative agenda, I am the chair of the Road User Fee Task Force, which has a bill in the legislature to update the Origo program, which is a voluntary program where you can sign up to pay by the mile instead of paying gas tax. And in a step toward a more complete use of it, maybe even being a replacement for state gas tax. The bill before the legislature right now, as you may be aware, the existing Origo system is very limited. It's only limited to a certain number of vehicles, and it also has a sunset date because it was only meant to be a pilot program. Well, the pilot program has been very successful, and we've seen no reason not to move it forward. So we made recommendation, and Representative Lively put a bill into the legislature that would remove the sunset and also remove the limit on how many vehicles can be involved in the program, but it also puts a restriction on what gas mileage your vehicle can get if you're going to be part of the program. As you may be aware, recently, there was a large fee put on high mileage vehicles for your license renewal. And if you, under the new bill, if the new bill passes, if you sign up to be part of the Origo project, then that would preclude you having to pay that higher fee to register your vehicle as well. So it would give people an incentive to utilize the per mile cost instead of paying gas tax by the gallon. And so that is moving forward. It is in Ways and Means. It's not subject to the drop-dead date because it came out of a joint committee, and so it's still alive in the legislature and moving forward.
Good work. I guess I can still sign up.
Pardon me?
I can still sign up again because they kicked me out when I moved out of state.
Well, you'll have to, yeah. With regard to that, we now know that the state of Oregon has been working directly with the states of California and Washington on a reciprocity process. And there's actually most of the western United States now have some sort of program similar that the expectation is once this process and program becomes fully baked and is in place as a system, that there will be some sort of a mutual agreement amongst all the states, at least in the western United States, on how you would balance that out. Also, Councillor Gonzalez and I had the opportunity to ride on Metro's or TriMet's new all-electric bus.
It's not Metrobus?
Yeah, Metrobus.
It's not our bus.
A TriMet bus that is 100% electric, and it will be serving the Line 62 line, which travels from Sunset Transit Center essentially down Murray Boulevard into that area. And some information here. Should have gotten these for everyone. I didn't even think of that.
I didn't think about that either.
But there's information about it.
Probably get some.
And we also got to watch them hook it up to recharge it when we got up to Sunset Transit Center to see how they're charging the high voltage, extremely high capacity charging system where the bus will, when it does its route, when it comes back, and while it's doing its 15-minute break for the driver, it will recharge for 15 minutes so that it can continue on its way all day long.
And that'll fully charge it?
It just tops it off. The bus itself has enough capacity that it could run its route multiple times, but it's easier on the battery and just safer if you can just top it off every loop it makes. And
yeah. So they said, sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
They said that it takes 15 minutes for the charge at Sunset Transit Center, and they built it into the driver's break time. So it was like, that's great.
And one of the things, the buses are more expensive than regular buses, but one of the points they made was that over the life of the bus, it will see about a $400,000 cost savings in fuel using electricity instead of diesel fuel.
I have a question.
question regarding the, or what do you call the, or...
Origo.
Origo. Uh-huh. So at what point do we transition the entire state into the system?
Great question. if Representative Lively and our Lively and I had our way, the bill in the legislature would make the per mileage fee statewide and mandatory for everyone. And it would replace state gas tax as the primary source of funding for road improvements and maintenance. But we recognize, and the committee recognizes, that politically it's something you need to do one step at a time. So hopefully this will pass, and that will be one more step and toward a goal of eventually, at least for me, eventually reaching a goal of achieving that.
There's so many questions about how
it works. And let me just put... round this out. The problem that we will continue to have until a deadline is set to make the change is that we will continue bonding against our existing gas tax and vehicle registration fee, which continues them into perpetuity.
Yeah.
So my belief is that until you put that deadline out there, that we will transfer to this new thing by this deadline as these bonds go to bed and we look to the future, we're going to be in this constant state of flux until that deadline is, like, whether it's 2040 or 2050, when we make a full transition, right? But we don't have that timeline, and nobody in the legislature is asking for that full transition.
And one way you could address that, and one process that's been in consideration is that when the time comes when we do make the decision to make the transition, the way you would make it is by making it would apply to vehicles manufactured after a certain date. So people who are currently own a car paying gas taxes would continue to do so. But if you bought a car that was manufactured after, say, January 1st, 2025, then you would pay by the mile instead.
Anyway, I just wanted to come back around to we had called for these posters to be made after there was an incident at MPAC where somebody had made a comment that, may I repeat it? We only speak English at this table. And I think that is, it was awful. And we want to make sure that doesn't ever happen again and that we're a welcoming environment for all folks of all cultures and all voices. So staff and communications and DEI put together this initial poster. I'm hoping that it starts to meet our needs. I feel like the three things that we're asking people to do aren't necessarily pulled out and bolded. But maybe we can think about how we can make this work going forward. And they're displayed already in every conference room. So thank you for pulling this together, Martha. I know it's important to all of us to make sure it's a welcoming environment. So they're out there. And if you have any comments or ideas about next steps with them, let me know. Anything else?
Bus was so cool this morning.
That's so cool.
I realized I became a total Metro nerd. You know, that's when I was like, I'm lost. I'm lost, though.
Awesome. All right. If there's no further business before this work session, we are adjourned. Thanks.
A little short of a million.